The great lockdown of 2020 had a large chunk of the Utah workforce working from home. That's an arrangement that a few public and private employers may want to maintain even after the lockdown. Find out why in this edition of Utah Thrives, the Utah Foundation podcast. I'm Peter Reichard. In April, Utah Foundation released a major report called Work Away From Work, The Challenges and Promise of Teleworking. It gives citizens and public and private sector leaders crucial guidance on teleworking. Later this year, Utah Foundation will issue a follow-up report looking at remote working in the context of air quality. We thank the Utah Clean Air Partnership, UCARE, for its support of both reports. In the meantime, to get further insights on the state of Utah's telework program, I spoke with Jeff Modishaw, Senior Consultant for Operational Excellence in the Governor's Office of Management and Budget. I began by asking him what motivated the state to launch a pilot program for teleworking back in 2018.
That's a great question. So there are several things that the state is concerned about. First and foremost, we have a concern about air quality. If you live in the state, you know what we're talking about. It's a both sides of the aisle concern. Everybody's working on it. Another thing that comes up all the time and is a concern for the current administration and others is how do we get more jobs out into the more rural parts of our state? So that's a second concern that's been ongoing, and a lot of things have been tried. Another thing is trying to recruit talent, and then once we get talent, how do we retain talent? Prior to COVID-19, of course, we had a super low unemployment rate in the state, and So we were all competing for this talent. So how can we attract talent and retain that talent? So those were three things that have just been ongoing things that we've been working on to try and improve in the state. Another issue that came up or was beginning to come up is as the population grows, the likelihood of having to hire more state employees to provide the services that we should to the citizens would require that we have space for those employees. Well, already the state leases quite a bit of space to augment the space that we own and operate to be able to provide these services. Well, we also have quite a number of buildings that were starting to get fairly old, 30, 40, 50 years old. So it was time to do something with those buildings. If we build a new building, that's tremendously expensive. If we could, say, refurbish or update or remodel existing buildings and be able to enhance utilization in those buildings, so we wouldn't have to build new buildings. And then if we could even go as far as being able to get out of some of the leases that we have and save money that way, sure, that would be a tremendous win.
Good old government efficiency, certainly near to my heart. Well, let's talk about each one of these areas, if you wouldn't mind. I mean, so we released our first report on teleworking recently. We didn't really get into the air quality issues. We'll be following up later this year with a subsequent report. But that was actually the original angle that we were taking when we took up the study, was really focusing on the air quality, potential air quality benefits. Were you able, or have you been so far, been able to gather enough information or get a picture potentially of what kind of air quality impacts you might be able to have through teleworking?
How we're trying to quantify that is, as we've decided that the pilot was successful and we're starting to roll it out across the whole state, then what we do is each person that participates in the program, then we capture some basic information on them. How do they get to and from work? If they're single occupant vehicle, carpool, if they're taking public transportation or active transportation, we have some people that do that. But if they're driving, single occupant vehicle, then we go a couple steps further. We say, okay, what year and what type of vehicle. Is it a car, SUV, truck, motorcycle? And then based on that, we've got some numbers from our Department of Environmental Quality to say, for say a 2012 sedan, the average for the state of Utah pollutants per mile would be X, right? And then we can say, okay, how many days are you teleworking? And how many miles would you have driven to and from work on an average commute? And so that's how we're going about collecting information to be able to see, hey, what kind of effect would that have? Now, we did that same philosophy for our pilot, and, you know, we saved 273 pounds over the course of several months, which is not a tremendous amount. But if you were to take that 136 people and then scale it up to, say, a couple of thousand people, then you can see that it starts to add up. So if the 136 are any indication of how much we could expect per person, then our goal of 2,555 teleworkers by the end of this calendar year, we estimate to save about 1,300 pounds per month in emissions.
What were you able to learn in terms of the potential for saving on space, or maximizing your space, as the case may be?
Yeah, this is an interesting one, and we're actually working quite a bit on this one. The state of Tennessee, who we talked with and got quite a bit of information and kind of modeled some of our program after, they had a two-year head start on us, and buildings and costs of real estate and stuff were the big drivers in them adopting a program like this. So we were thinking and expecting that we would have some benefits here. So we initially thought, okay, if we can get people out of the office and those that participate, if they're teleworking at least the majority of the time, then we should be able to share space, right? Mm-hmm. At least two people might be able to share the same space because they could offset or whatever. But how much of the overall employee base would that be, and what kind of effect would that have? We realized some people wouldn't be able to participate, et cetera. But as we got into it, we realized some other things were starting to happen. For example, to have a robust teleworking program, even if you don't participate as a teleworker, everybody in that team or group needs to assume that they're a teleworking employee, because all of the processes and everything that would be in place to support the teleworkers needs to happen for those that are in the office. So something simple like a paperless process for how you guys do business needs to be implemented. Well, as you start to take away things like paper, you realize that the amount of space that you need to be able to do your job isn't as great, because you look at the way we design offices, cubicles, that kind of thing. We design these big L-shaped desks so we can work and lay our paper out. Then we have filing cabinets and lateral files and uppers and lowers and all of that kind of stuff. Well, if you don't have that much paper, you don't have that much stuff, and you're more mobile, you don't move into a space the same way you did before. So we've actually, taking that into consideration, we have redone the state space standards. So what we use for space, the size of a cubicle and offices for the different types of work activities. But when you start to incorporate all of that and the people starting to work outside of the office, now we're really starting to see that there's some great potential. We've hired a consulting company to come in and actually help us put a master plan together for along the Wasatch Front, saying, okay, now that we're going to have a robust teleworking program, what can we do? How can we rearrange all these people in the existing space, remodeling some of it to be able to accommodate more people, more types of work activities? And then what would the effect be? Mm-hmm. And really, depending on how aggressive the state wants to be and what it looks like when we get through the rest of the departments, you know, we might be looking at a 15, 20, or even 30% better utilization than what we had before. That's big when you're talking about the 22,000 employees. Right. It starts to mean something. So that's quite exciting news. We have one department that's one of our first departments, right out The first one after the pilot was our Department of Health, and they had serious space issues. And they've already been able to consolidate some of their buildings. They're looking at getting out of their first lease at the end of this calendar year. And they've been able to absorb 50 additional employees for the Medicaid expansion in their existing space, which they didn't think would be possible. So that's quite exciting news.
Another one of your goals was to increase job growth in rural areas. And talk about that a little bit. You know, you don't have a very large sample size of rural employees for this program yet, right?
Right, because we haven't been through all the departments. And this will mature over time as the program matures over time as well. And everybody thought, okay, right out of the bat, we can now start to offer jobs in rural Utah. So we could say, hey, we have this person who lives in rural Utah, and they can now apply for a job and stay there if they get the job. That has two positive effects as we see it. One, we can bring a job to that part of the state. But two, what it does is it opens up our recruiting efforts. We can now recruit across the whole state for a lot of jobs where historically we may have only been recruiting a certain area. So potential for access to more talent and also the economic benefits that come with a good job in some of those parts. What's interesting, though, is after the pilot program, we started hearing a lot from existing state employees who said, hey, I really want to move back to rural Utah. I'm only living here in the Wasatch Front because this is where the jobs were, but I grew up here or there in this great place in the state, and I would love to be able to go back and raise my family there. Or we even have other people that say, hey, you know what? I would rather move off the Wasatch Front because if I go to one of these smaller towns, I can have a better lifestyle than I have here because I can buy a nicer home and I can have more real estate or access to maybe recreational things, that type of stuff. So there's a lot of people that are along the Wasatch Front that are also excited to be able to participate, that they might be able to move off the Wasatch Front. But housing costs along the Wasatch Front are going up, and we're expecting more and more and more people here, right? And we have the lakes and the mountains, and so we're starting to go up and, you know, higher density housing, all of that. So maybe this is a way to potentially ease some of that burden. I don't know if it'll be enough. But for some of these smaller towns, I've been told by people that if you get 3, 4, 5, maybe 10 good paying jobs into some of these small rural towns, that's enough to have a positive economic impact on that community. This also falls over into that, can we retain talent? You think about that too, right? If you have somebody that grew up in a small town and they thought they would have to wait until they retired to be able to get to that small town, they might always be looking for a job down there. Or they might stay with the state because now they have the opportunity to live where they've always wanted to live and have that. So we might be able to retain people and then start to recruit more people.
In our report, one of the things we talk about is the fact that increasingly the option of telecommuting will actually be a recruiting tool, and I guess retention as well, but that increasingly your employees, certainly in the private sector, are going to be expecting that option. Do you feel it's the same way within the public sector sphere here in Utah?
I do. I don't have any peer-reviewed research to suggest that other than what I've read from others. But there is some anecdotal evidence to suggest that, even with some of the groups we've already been working with. One of the groups that's been participating since the beginning in one of the departments, they have a very, very high percentage of participating teleworkers, and their job really lends itself well to teleworking. It can be done anywhere. It's great. They were already moving electronically anyway, but the director did kind of an informal survey of his employees and just said, hey, how much benefit is teleworking to you? For example, if you were to leave, and he was trying to quantify it, he said, if you were to leave and take another job, and historically they've had a higher turnover rate. He said, if you were to leave and take another job, that didn't offer teleworking, how much more money would they have to pay you than what you're making now? So his idea was, maybe I can try and put a dollar figure or quantify how much value that had. He told me that the average of his informal survey here was about $12,000. So certainly not peer reviewed or anything, but what was happening is people were saying, hey, teleworking has a value to me. Like, I would be willing to work for a little less money if I had teleworking as an option. And if I didn't, then I would expect to be paid more.
Right.
So I think that's interesting and in line with some of the other research that you can read, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the way we do business now, right? We do so much business like we're doing now, where we're on video calls or a lot of virtual meetings, a lot of email, a lot of that kind of stuff. And people they expect to be able to get a hold of us when we're at home as well, right? They expect us to answer our cell phone when we call and stuff. So those two worlds are kind of colliding anyway. So why couldn't I just start working from home earlier than the day than rather than waiting till after dinner?
Right. What is the longer term outlook here? I mean, obviously we're going through this crisis right now where you've got massive amounts of people teleworking. I mean, do you feel like this experience from the state's standpoint accelerates the move towards telework?
It certainly accelerated it. We were taking a staggered systematic approach because what we wanted to do with each department as we broadened and implemented this program on a wide scale is we wanted to come in with resources and support so they didn't have to recreate anything. So we could bring in tools and resources and training and help that rollout be smoother and successful right out of the gate. We feel like teleworking on its own merits is not essentially successful or unsuccessful, not good or bad, but rather it's the execution of the program which can lead to highly successful outcomes or unsuccessful outcomes. So that was our approach. Then you enter COVID-19, right? Mm-hmm. We were only halfway through our plan. Mm-hmm. Well, over one weekend, the other half got to go out. Certainly yeah. It accelerated it.
How much of that is permanent now? You know, how much of it sticks? Do you have any sense of that? Do you have a bigger proportion of your state workforce that just becomes the new status quo for them?
I'm going to give a little context to my answer and tell you the things that we suspected, that we know, and then what we suspect. We know that not every position at the state is conducive to teleworking. A great example of that is a correctional officer at the prison. Their job requires them to be present. However, we do know that there are quite a number of jobs, and this might increase over time as well. And we did a survey in 2018, our HR department did, and supervisor self-reporting determined that 38% of the state's workforce, their jobs could be done successfully in a remote situation, okay, mm-hmm. telework. So we said if 38% would be the total that could telework based on their job duties and everything, but we estimate that to be about 8,500 people. Now, we also know, looking at some of the other more robust programs, interviewing people that have participated and a lot of research, is that you might have the perfect remote office setup. You might have the perfect job conducive to remote work. But personally, it doesn't align with you. You don't like working from home, or you don't like working from a remote location. So we wanted our program to have that at the end user, the employee level, that it was a voluntary thing.
Right.
So we knew that it was highly unlikely that we would reach 100% of the potential teleworkers, those suitable to telework, because we wanted to give that as an option to employees. And then, of course, there's the group that not a lot of people talk about, which are the ones that maybe we don't offer it to them, even though their job is because of other things. Maybe they're working on improving their performance. Maybe they're having some other issues or something. Maybe they're in a training mode and the training needs to be done on site or something. So we knew we would never get to 100%. Now, that said, the latest numbers that I have, we have about 39% of the state's workforce teleworking right now. So believe it or not, we're at what we estimated would be 100% of people that can teleworking right now. So we feel like our numbers were pretty good on our estimates because we pretty much nailed it. And every department that I've spoken to has said exactly what you're suggesting. We're at full capacity right now, but when we start to release and come back to work, it's going to shrink down because, one, not everybody wants to telework all the time. And quite frankly, not all of the departments were quite ready for a long-term, robust teleworking program. Mm-hmm. They will get there, but it might be that they shrink down a little bit and improve some processes, put some technology in place, do some things for future people to go back out more long-term and be successful. Now, here's what we don't know. We don't know how many people have had this experience and will say, oh, it's not as bad as I thought it was, or this is great, or I do not want to do that ever again, right? We'll have to let that settle just a little bit. We have loosened our requirements just a little bit so that we can get more people out right now to keep them safe. So some people will be coming back into the office because we'll have little stricter requirements on service levels and stuff like that.
How much do you think the state of Utah's experience with teleworking prior to the outbreak has helped during this crisis? I mean, how much more resilient has our state government been as a result?
Well, I could tell you right now, our five goals, not a single one of them is emergency preparedness or continuum of operations. And the moment that the governor's office said, we need to get everybody out and accelerate our implementation of teleworking, which meant within a week, the other 50% of the departments began large-scale teleworking. That was only possible because of what we had already done. For example, the state already had VPN solutions. We already had virtual desktop solutions and higher security protocols for certain groups of people. We already had certain levels of bandwidth. But when we started talking about teleworking, we realized that none of that was going to be robust enough for the numbers that we were talking about. So early on in the pilot, even the second we decided this was going live, the legislature funded us some money and we were able to start building that infrastructure to support. So that's something that a lot of people don't talk about. They think about, well, just leave and go home and start working. Well, if you have a desktop at work and you don't have, you know, secure VPN connections, or you don't have phone services, or, you know, just simple things like forwarding your desk phone to your cell phone sounds like a great solution, except, right, that doubles up the number of lines you need in your phone. Then you're calling out on your personal cell phone. There's just a lot of that behind the scenes that people don't think about that you need to have set up and robust enough so that you can have a good user experience on the back end for the employee, but and for the customer.
Right. It's a great time to be selling laptops and
fantastic time.
To be a broadband provider, right?
Here's something simple. I was just talking with our ID department. You know what's sold out right now? Cheap USB webcams. Because there's so many people in this COVID era right now that are now doing so many virtual meetings, and they're realizing that it's more enjoyable to do it video if you can. And so they're buying up a whole bunch of these. But having all of that infrastructure in place allowed for us to scale up very quickly. Over the weekend, we were able to scale up the other 50% of the departments and even additional people in the first departments, get them set up with VPN profiles, get that all done, get them. And everyone had started thinking about teleworking, so they'd already been in the mode of replacing desktop computers with laptops and things like that. And then we had a program, a step-by-step program for how we would get people out the door successfully. We already had trainings that we had created that were online accessible to supervisors and employees. So over the course of just a couple of days, we were able to give tools, and not the one-on-one help that we wanted to, but we were able to give them a packet of tools and everything that they needed that they could roll out on their own with minimal help and be highly successful. I mean, without that, it would have been very, very difficult.
Let me ask you what your advice would be as to the pitfalls and addressing isolation issues that some employees might feel.
Yeah. So, in fact, one of the trainings available in our documentation are these, what I call the three C's. The first one is culture, second one is communication, and the third is collaboration. Sometimes I call it coordination, but on a high level, I believe that those three things cover most of the pitfalls and issues that you run into. Everyone says, well, collaboration's going to go away. Well, not necessarily, right? If you're expecting your collaboration to happen serendipitously in the hallway when you pass, or you're talking at the water cooler, then yeah, some of that might be a little bit difficult and go away. But if you get in a room and you have big whiteboards and you have this really interactive collaboration, yeah, that's going to change. So you got to figure that out and how you might be able to recreate that in a different way and still have that input. But that ties in a little bit to communication. One thing that I've heard said over and over with teleworking communication is over-communication is communication when you're teleworking. Now, is that right or not? I think the point is that you really have to be more intentional and deliberate with your communication. Don't wait for people to ask you. You have to be more proactive. And we even recommend and train with our departments is that you sit down and come up with communication charter, I've heard it called, or kind of some agreed upon protocols. How often do I check in? What's the cadence? What's your preferred method of receiving communication from me for different types of things? Evernote, in a podcast I heard, said something that was fantastic. They said, look, don't send an email if your house is on fire. Like, there's a proper channel and a way to communicate certain information. But I saved what I think is the most important one for last, and that's the culture. And you need to develop a culture within your organization that reinforces teleworking. Everything can kind of be rolled up into that one big piece, which is have a culture that reinforces it. If you have one supervisor that requires every single meeting to be in person, you don't have a teleworking culture.
Right.
If everything you do is in paper, your program's broke, right? It's not going to happen. If you're trying to manage people's presence over their performance, it's broken. So some of these things people don't realize they're doing. If you tweak them just a little bit, once again, you can go from unsuccessful to successful or back the other way. But it's really a culture that reinforces and supports teleworking.
And let me get back to something that may be the most interesting or striking thing about teleworking that we found, and I think that you all may have found as well, is increased employee productivity. Part of that may be due to reduced absenteeism. But tell me why you think that's been the trend. I believe you all had similar observations at the state level.
Yeah. Yeah. The first thing everybody, I think, believes increases that results in increases in productivity is they say, hey, I don't get bugged as much. I just don't have so many breaks in my work. So I feel like I can just get in the zone and I can really get something done. I believe that plays a lot into it. If you've ever heard of the corporate drive-by, hey, how you doing this morning, Peter? Hey, Jeff, how's it going? Great. That might take you as long as 10 to 15 minutes to get back to the place you were to be able to be productive in the work you're doing. But you start to add in things too. Like a lot of us, when we're in the office, when we have meetings, we have to factor in time to get from one meeting to the next, right? They're never in the same room stacked on top of each other. So I think that has something to do with it. There's some other literature that I read that says people that get the opportunity to telework, a lot of them feel, I don't know, obligated is maybe not the best word for it, but they feel like they want to give back and prove that they're doing a good job and things like that. So I think inherently people focus on trying to be more productive.
Right.
Right. I think that plays into it a little bit. Some other things we've seen with some departments that were high performers before that are still getting positive increases in productivity is when you make the switch over, you start to rethink all of your processes.
Right.
And how you're getting work done and stuff. And simple things. For example, we had one group that they wrote lots and lots and lots of contracts. So there was paper being passed around for signatures constantly. Well, a simple change of going to electronic signature, all of a sudden that started shaving days off of the time that it was taken to execute the contract. Nothing changed with the employees.
Right.
Now, the thing that I think makes the biggest difference, all of that is good, but the thing I think that makes the biggest difference is if you have supervisors who have historically supervised by managing that people make it to work on time and sit in their chairs a sufficient amount of time during the day, then you're managing to the wrong things. And most people will act in accordance with the way that they're measured. So if people really embrace a culture of managing for performance and not presence, then they really start to manage for the right things, which is empowering not only, I believe, to the organization, but to the employee.
It takes away the option for the manager to manage in that way. The manager has to manage in a task-oriented manner rather than did you show up and fill your seat for 8 hours, because that's off the table now.
That's right. Yeah, and for most people, I'm a believer that most people want to do a good job. And the key of a good manager is helping that person know what good looks like.
Right.
And once they know what good looks like, then the task switches to helping remove obstacles for them to be high performers. And then most people will work to doing a good job. By starting to manage to that kind of performance and the outcomes and stuff, that's helping people to get to a point where they say, okay, here's the desired outcome. And a lot of people can figure out how to get there. There's a lot of smart people out there who want to do a good job. And that takes a lot of some of that micromanaging and stuff out of the way. And then you add in all this other stuff where you're not requiring them to spend half their day getting from one meeting to the next. And they're not being constantly interrupted. You start to think through, okay, how are we going to communicate with each other so we communicate enough, but it's not too distracting or it's not too overwhelming or the wrong information's in the wrong channel. Then people can really start to get in the zone of getting work done. That's why I think you see increases in productivity.
Anything we didn't cover?
No, I just maybe want to reiterate one more time that if you look in the news and you read research, you can find case studies that show that teleworking is not good, and you can find case studies that show that teleworking is good. Some are hugely successful, some are epically failing. And really, I think the key with it is in the execution.
And that's true of government, state governments across the country, right?
Yeah. And so I think that's good, because one of the things that comes up all the time when I talk about teleworking is people say things, oh yeah, it's the greatest thing ever, based on this company or that company, or look at Yahoo, or look at IBM, or look at somebody big that should have been able to pull it off and didn't. So yeah, I think it really comes down to the execution. And you know, if people are interested, we have quite a bit of information up on our Governor's Office of Management and Budget website that's available for folks if they are interested.
What's the website?
gomb.utah.gov. And you'll find it under a new workplace, modernizing where, how, and when Utah works.
Well, Jeff, this has been a delightful and interesting conversation. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for your time, Peter.
This has been Utah Thrives, the Utah Foundation podcast. Follow our work at utahfoundation.org.